Philippians 1:27 to 30, we read this. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that, whether I come and see you or whether I remain absent in prison, I should hear that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, by contending side by side for the faith, or for the faith of the gospel. Do not be intimidated in any way by your opponents. This is a sign of their destruction, but of your salvation, a sign which is from God. For it has been granted to you not only to believe in Christ, but also to suffer for him. Since you are encountering the same conflict that you saw me face and now hear that I am facing. So that's our passage for tonight. Just four verses. Let's look at verse 27. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Well, when it says conduct yourselves here, we see that this is the Greek word from which we get our term political. This comes from the root word polis, which was in the Greek a city-state. And so this is the verbal form. Conduct yourself politically. Conduct yourself like a polis. Conduct yourself like a policeman. What is this getting at here? It means literally, like a city-state, to be a citizen, or to conduct yourselves as citizens in the verbal form, or to live as citizens of heaven. So when Paul says, conduct yourselves, he's saying, as though you're citizens of heaven. Later he's going to say, in Philippians 3:20, that he uses the noun form, he says, you are citizens of heaven. Now, this would have really rung true for this particular church, because in this Roman colony of Philippi, they really placed a high premium on their Roman citizenry. Because if you were a Roman citizen, what this meant is that you had all of the privileges and the rights that were afforded thereto. You could get a Roman trial, you had Roman protection. I mean, this was to be at the top of the social strata. And so when Paul is using this language of citizenry, he's really striking at the chord of what they took pride in. And so here, he's saying, yeah, just like your Roman citizenry, only way better. I know in your time and place, in your culture, you think that being a Roman citizen is the best thing in the world. Well, this citizenry that we're speaking about here, even better. You know, to get a Roman citizenry, you just needed to do either one of two things. One, you could be born in Rome. Or two, you could pay to become a Roman citizen. To be a United States citizen, what you need to do is study 100 questions that have to do with government and the government of the United States. And then you take a test where you answer 10 questions. And if you can't see the fine print, you have to answer 6 out of the 10 questions correctly to pass. When it comes to being a citizen of heaven, according to the Bible, you need to answer one question correctly. Jesus himself asked a woman, he said this in John chapter 11, he said, everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. You know what the word believe is in the Bible? That means to trust. Whoever trusts in me, you'll never die. Do you believe this? It's a simple question. This is a question that a 3- or 4-year-old could answer. It's not that it's difficult to understand, but it's difficult in its implications. The implications are these. You mean that I've been spending my entire life trying to be a good person, trying to do the right thing, and yet I'm in the same boat as everyone else when it comes to this issue? You mean all those things I've ever done, they don't add up to anything when it comes to going to heaven? See, some people read this question and it's the most insulting thing they have ever heard in their entire lives. Other people read this question and it is the greatest news they have ever heard in their entire lives. Do you trust in yourself, in your own self-righteousness, or do you trust in the righteousness of Jesus Christ? This is really what's at issue when it comes to this subject. And this is really the basis on which we become a citizen of heaven. Paul continues, he says, so that's who you are. You're citizens of heaven because you've come to know Christ. Then he says, to unpack this further, he says, whether I come and see you or whether I remain absent. So whether I'm there with you in this church or whether you're not seeing me. And so what's he describing here? He's describing a relationship that is not codependent. Codependent. That, you know, whether Paul is there or not, I'm still going to be doing the same things. Whether someone I admire is in the room or not, I'm still going to be doing the same things. You know, it's not like when you were in high school and you had a substitute teacher and the sub would go out of the room and you would just go ballistic, like doing whatever it is that you did. I'm not talking about myself here. Like, I just sat there and sharpened my pencils. But like other kids, like they would like go crazy. You know what I mean? Because like when the cat's away, you know, the mice will play. And Paul's like, that's not who you are. You're not codependent on some kind of a spiritual authority. Like, that's helpful. That's helpful, but you're not codependent in that way. Yet he says you are dependent in another way. You're dependent on each other. This word here, standing firm in one spirit, is in the plural. So it isn't just me, myself, and I trying to make a stand for Christ. It's not me, it's we. Like, I remember in high school, we used to go to these mosh pits, or no, like you go to a mosh pit, like you walk into a Wendy's and there's like a mosh pit in there. When I was in high school, we used to go to punk rock concerts where there were mosh pits. And I remember being in there and there was all these like, you know, like pretty rough and tumble guys, you know. And, you know, the guy would, you know, be playing the music and the music would hit and all of a sudden it would just be like a mass of, you know, swirling humanity. And you just get, you know, thrown up in it and it was just like you couldn't control it. And I just imagine like trying to be there like in the middle of that, just with, like with my feet planted, like, yeah, come and get it, baby, you know. Like I would just get totally pummeled. But just imagine if I had a friend with me and then another friend and then a fourth and a fifth and then 30 friends. We could do some damage, you know what I'm saying? So I wouldn't just get carried around by that mass of humanity, but I actually could make a difference in that scenario. So there's a sense where we're not codependent in some kind of an unhealthy, sick sort of a way, but we're depending on others. Then he says this, you're of one mind. One mind. The Christian community is one mind. By this, he does not mean unanimity, like unanimous. Where if we were to vote, we would all vote the same way. Also, he does not mean uniformity, that we all have the same behavior, the same dress, the same clothing, the same speech, nothing like that. That's not what one mind means. What this means is that Christians have all decided that we are going to agree upon the essential convictions of the Christian faith. We agree on our mission. We agree where we're going, and how we get there and how we do it, we could have some disagreement. There could be some peripheral issues that we disagree upon, that's true. But when it comes to core, central Christianity, we agree on that. That's our centerpiece. So, what this means is, watch out for those who are nitpickers and those who are bickering and those who are, you know, talking about all these little tiny little minutia things going on. When I see people like that, the first thing that comes to mind is that they aren't on the mission. They're not. Could you imagine being in war and you're sitting there with your fellow soldier and you're on this mission and he's nitpicking about how you buttoned up your shirt that day? Or I'm really annoyed by the way you chew with your mouth open. You know, something like that. What are you talking about? We're in the middle of a war. We don't talk like that here. And you know, I would never say this to one person, but I will say it to 200 people. Would you shut up with that? Would you stop bickering and, oh, I don't like it this way. I don't know why she said it that way. Would you shut up with that? Keep it focused. The reason when I fall into annoyance and bickering, why is that? It's because I'm so focused on stupid things and I've taken my mind off of the one mind, the mission, the importance. He says, contending side by side. This is the word used for athletics and it's the Greek prefix sune. So sune athlountes. So playing together. But really, in the New Testament, this word has a military connotation. So it means to struggle or to fight or to contend or to be competitive. Sune. Together. Ralph Martin says this imagery would remind the Philippian readers, these Romans, of the Roman phalanx, you know, where they're all linked in together with their swords. consisting of a body of trained spearmen who fought in closed ranks. So again, you see the picture? This isn't me, myself, and I trying to lead the world to Christ. This is we, one mind working together for what? For the cause of Jesus Christ. So if we were to summarize all of this, what we just read, we're dependent, but we're not codependent. I have my relationship with Christ. That comes first. And yet Christ speaks to me and builds me up and corrects me and directs me through other people. We're standing together, not alone. We're focused with one mind over the central essentials of the Christian faith and our mission as to what we're doing. We're contending side by side in a fight. That is the language being evoked here. And finally, this is for the cause of Jesus Christ. Then he says in verse 28, this shouldn't surprise us, should it? Do not be intimidated in any way by your opponents. So with all that military language and working together and one-minded and fighting alongside each other for this mission and this cause and this in this world that desperately needs it, Paul says there's going to be opposition to this. Yes, opposition. In fact, this word intimidated, this is a vivid term. It's used to refer to uncontrollable, startled horses in a stampede. Okay? It was used of horses which spook. You know how scary a horse is that spooks? I don't. I've never seen a horse before, okay? I grew up in the city, all right? But on TV and movies, they look pretty scary. Like their eyes could, you know, blow up to the size of, you know, grapefruits and stuff, and they're kicking their legs all around. That's the language here, okay? And he's saying, don't be spooked. Don't be scared. Don't be startled. Don't be panicked by your what? By your opponents. He says this is a sign. What is a sign? Do not be intimidated in any way by your opponents. This is a sign. In context, this refers to your reaction to the opponents. Your reaction to the opponents. So if you panic, that will be a sign. Yet if you remain calm and courageous, that too will be a sign. He says this is a sign. Not being intimidated, calm, courageous, having the temerity to stand up against people who are opposing Christ. This is a sign of their destruction, but of your salvation, a sign which is from God. Think about this for a second. When I'm being intimidated or falsely accused by someone, what does it imply if I panic? If someone is saying, you know, launching accusations, you know, hurling insults, name-calling, trying to muscle, intimidate me, and I cower in fear, and I panic, and I get scared, what does that signify, not just to that person, but to everyone in the room? What does it signify? That what they're saying is true. That I'm guilty. Because if what they were saying wasn't true, then I wouldn't feel scared. Like, I was counseling a young man recently, a six-year-old young man, and someone had called him a name. And I said, you know, that is just so stupid that they called you that name. I said, young man, what if they called you an elephant? How would you feel about it then? He's like, well, that would be really stupid. I said, why would it be stupid? He said, because I'm not an elephant. I said, precisely. If someone hurls insults and accusations against me and they're not true, why should I be panicking? Why should I be guilty? Think about it like this. Why am I the one who is feeling morbidly guilty about these accusations? I'm the one who gave my life to Jesus Christ. I'm not saying I'm sinless. Yeah, you spent 5 minutes with me. You know that. Okay, that's stupid. Okay, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm the one who gave my life to Jesus Christ and said, I want to follow you with my entire adult life. Thick or thin, I don't care what happens. I'm in with you. Okay, I'm the one who's wanting to seek God's will. I'm the one who's here imperfectly trying to serve and love other people. I'm the one who's praying for other people. I'm the one walking around with inordinate morbid guilt. Why am I being intimidated? Paul says, oh, just the opposite. They are the ones who should see this as a sign that when they hurl the accusations, when they hurl the insults, when they defame you, when they publicly embarrass you, and you keep your cool, and you keep your calm, and you keep your courage, This is a sign. It's a sign that communicates to them and to everyone else that what they're saying has no truth. And so he says in verse 29, for, there's the connecting word, for, he's building on this idea of persecution. It has been granted to you not only to believe in Christ, but also to suffer for him. Now, does this mean that God causes the suffering? No. No more than he causes you to trust in him. He granted this. He gave you the opportunity to believe, but you had to choose. And now we need to choose if we're going to willingly suffer for Jesus Christ. That's some bitter medicine. Since you are encountering the same conflict that you saw in me, Acts 16, Paul was beaten, put in stocks, imprisoned in a Philippian jail. You saw in me. And now here that I am facing, I'm continuing to be put in house arrest. So this is the question that is confronting us from this passage here this evening. Are you willing to take a stand for Jesus Christ, even if it means enduring personal pain and suffering and persecution? Have you made up your mind about this in advance, that I'm going to stick in with Christ through thick or thin? Well, that's our subject for tonight, standing for Christ. I've heard some people say something like this. I don't know if you've heard this before. You know, I like the idea of Christian community, like we do all this together and we're, you know, fighting together and we know we're in athletics together and we hang out together. I like that. Like in our world today too, everyone's talking about community, community, community. We need more community. The problem is communities are getting ripped apart and we don't know why. Well, I'm all for communities of any kind, but I'm telling you this, what you need at the center of a stable and enduring community is God. That's what brings us together. People of all different types of race and gender and views and all of us, we're a pack of strays. I mean, we're a bunch of weirdos. And you put us all in the same room and people are like, why? Why you? Why do you guys love each other? Well, it's because of God is at the center of this community. This is not a social club, okay? This is not some kind of a thing that you pay your fees to get into and then, you know, we have some kind of affinity. The centerpiece is God. Tangent. I like the idea of Christian community, but we push too hard for our mission. We push too hard for our mission. Now let's think about this for a second. For one, this is not our mission. This is the cause of Jesus Christ. And when God himself hands to you a responsibility like this, nothing less than to have good men and women throughout the world trying to make an impact for eternity on this world that so desperately needs it. When God gives that to you and your responsibility and you start to refer to it as our mission, you have got the cart before the horse here. We need to realize this is God's mission that he has handed to us. Second, I'd like to ask this. Is there any cause? Is there any mission that you could think of for which you'd be willing to sacrifice? Like, just think about that for a second. Like, your life is happening. You're getting your degree, you're getting your job, you're getting your life in order. Cool, 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 great. Okay, is there anything that could come into the middle of that that would be worth sacrificing for? Let me just say this. There is no cause on earth that could have more gravity, that could have more substance, that could have more meaning than the cause of Christ. None. I mean, I don't mean like it's close, like, you know, it's like the cause of Christ, and then there's like a number two that's really close. I mean, it's like all the causes on earth are good to some extent, and then the cause of Christ is through the stratosphere. Because what we're reading here is that I am a citizen of heaven, okay? That's where I'm going. That's where I belong. Like, I'm here on earth right now, but I'm going there. I'm going back there. That's my citizenry, and I'm going to be there relatively soon. My God, does this go fast? Guys, I blinked. I woke up, and I had a mortgage. And people were talking about this word I had never heard or like defined, or I didn't even know how to spell it. Retirement. Like, what's your plans for retirement? I was like, what are you saying? What does that mean? I look over in bed. There's this strange woman laying next to me. She's been there for 11 years. These two little boys, they climb up into bed. All of a sudden, I'm like an adult. I think I'm an adult now. I think that happened. God, this happened so fast. I was sitting right there listening to an old Bible teacher teach the Bible, and I snapped my fingers and 17 years went by. God, this happens fast. And I'm going to be in heaven, and I'm going to be there forever. So it's going to be soon, and it's going to be forever. So that's why we're reading that we're supposed to stand firm and contend and suffer in this conflict. Why? Because this is only temporal or temporary, and that is eternal. What might happen? Let me ask you this. What might happen if we didn't have a common cause or mission of sacrificial love in Christian community? I'll tell you what would happen, because I've been in groups like this. When people start to make Christian community about itself, as an end in itself, it atrophies and it dies. It atrophies and it dies. Like getting a cast on your leg and you don't use that muscle for 6 months and then you take the cast off and that leg just looks shriveled by comparison. That's Christian community without a mission. If this isn't outward love to other people, that is sick, disgusting spirituality. That is not from God, and God will not back it. And so that's why you have the nitpicking, the infighting, the comparison, the performance, pushing. That's why you get all that stuff. Why? Because we're so focused on ourselves. That's why. No, that's not the way to go. Are we too focused on our mission? What about this? You know, okay, that was kind of a ruse. That was a ruse. It's not that I think we're too focused. It's that honestly, I'm afraid of what people will think of me. You know what everybody likes? Everybody. A little bit of religion. Everybody likes that. Oh, you got a little bit of religion? Oh, that's good. That's cute. That's great. You pray? You a spiritual person? You are? That's great. Oh. Yeah. You know what no one likes? When you start to say, Jesus Christ is at the center of my life. People don't like that. It's funny. It's like, yeah, no, he's changed my life. He's come into my life and it's different. My dysfunctions are starting to melt away and I start, have an ability to love and relate to other people and have actual conversations. And it's like, but you're getting really into that all of a sudden. And, there's some pushback. There's some opposition to that. There's sometimes even some opponents to that. What do we say? It's kind of scary. Well, here I would ask you this. Do you appease people in other areas of your life as well? Or only in the most important area of your life? You know, there comes a point in your life and your maturity as a follower of Jesus where you get to the point where you just don't care what other people think about your convictions. I just have stopped caring, you know, when people have written things about me or said things about me, or did you hear what they said about you? I just don't care anymore. I've given up caring. I'm not living for some yokel's opinion on the internet, okay? I don't care about him. And I'm talking this week, I got blasted, all right, this past week. And I read that and I thought, I don't care about what he thinks of me. I care about what he thinks of me. And if I get into this pattern where I'm going to start to appease people on the most important issue in my life, once you cross that bridge, what are you not willing to cross? Are your convictions for sale? You know, are you willing to give up on your convictions for Jesus Christ if somebody pays the right amount of money, if the right opportunity opens up? Like, yeah, I'm still really into God, but, you know, he's going to come second place to whatever it is in your life. I don't know what it is for you. I don't know what would take place as the top thing in your life, but you do. You know what it would be. Are you for sale? See, in our relationships, when we get into relationships with others and we show that we are different in this one area, that we think that God is where it's at, and love, relationships are where it's at, and building this and fostering this, other people who aren't into that are going to start to sense tension. Tension. I remember as a drug user, when I came to Christ, I was like, I don't feel like I need this anymore. It's so cool. One of the coolest things. Like I'd be having like the time of my life, you know, like an amusement park or like a movie or like a party. I'd just be having fun. And I always would be thinking to myself, man, I should just get high, you know? And then I was like, no, you're actually like enjoying your life. Like you don't need to get high anymore. And so then I would go and hang out with my friends, and they'd all be getting high, and they'd be like, so yeah, let's pass it around to you. And I'd be like, no thanks. You know, I just like enjoy my life. I'm just happy with life. That created tension. And you know what tension is? Tension is good. Tension shows that there's something different that happened, that you have something different in your life. What would it mean that if I came into contact and relationship with the God of the universe, the cosmic creator, and nothing changed in my life? There'd be no tension whatsoever. Finally, nobody thinks about you as much as you. Like you walk into a room and you're like, I wonder what people are going to say about me. I wonder what they think about me. Like, I wonder if they think I'm a Christian or something. You know, like you're all psyched out. Okay, listen, whenever you walk into a party, everyone's having those thoughts, okay, to one degree or another. If they're not having those thoughts, they're having different thoughts. And everyone's thinking to themselves, I'm the only weirdo here. And nobody's thinking about you. I'm telling you that for real. Like right now, I'm not thinking about any of you, okay? No offense. Maybe you need a little bit of what they call exposure therapy. You know what this is? There was a young man back in the 50s, who was terrified of social anxiety, specifically speaking to women. So he was studying psychology, and he decided what he was going to do is he was going to sit out in what was maybe the equivalent of the Oval, only on his university. And he was going to sit there and respectfully and politely, all right? Those are the two adverbs you need to remember here. Respectfully and politely. Not creepily, not weirdly, okay. So he's sitting out there, and in a month's time, he talked to 130 women. Can I get an amen, all right? This guy, 130 women in 30 days. I don't even know what the math is. That's like, all right, check this out. 30 of the women, when he said, hi, how are you? My name is Albert. They just got up and left right away. He was scared to death of talking to women. He said after that month was over, his social anxiety was completely removed. So much so that he developed a therapy. It's referred to as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's actually one of the foremost therapies around today. His name is Albert Ellis, one of the fathers of cognitive behavioral therapy. And so when you go into a situation that you're afraid of and then you kind of back out and retreat, that only reinforces the fear. What Ellis learned is when I go into the situation and push through it and push through it and push through it, the fear evaporates. Well, finally, why is it that we have opponents at all? I mean, we're focused on the love of Christ. Why would anyone not be into that? Well, opposition can come from people hearing information about Christ. I mean, we see this in the New Testament. Like, we should expect to have opponents. We should expect to have enemies. Jesus taught it. Paul taught it. John taught it. Peter taught it. Enemies and opponents. It's not that we want to be enemies with anybody. It's not that we want to hurt anybody, obviously. But other people are saying, no, I'm your enemy. Persecution is taught throughout the New Testament. So this whole idea of, oh man, if we were just a more loving, you know, grace-centered kind of Christian community, then we wouldn't have opponents and we wouldn't have enemies. Not true. Not according to what we're reading here. You were in a church with Paul or Peter? They had enemies. They had opponents. It's just not true. It's simply not true. Persecution, though, I got the easy step program to avoid persecution. One step. You guys ready? It's easy. Distort Jesus' teaching. Persecution goes away. I mean, it's really awesome. Like, if you just, like, give up on Jesus' message and his teaching, the persecution will be gone tomorrow. It's going to be great. Okay? Like Galatians 6:12. Paul says, those who want to make a good impression are trying to compel you to be circumcised or get underneath the law. He says, the only reason that they do this, it's not theological, it's not philosophical, it's not traditional. The only reason they do this is to avoid being persecuted for the cross of Christ. If you want to get out of this, like taking a stand for Christ, the quickest way is to jettison the Bible. Jettison Jesus' teaching. No more. That would be your quickest escape. There was a Barna study that was done 2 years ago. It found this, that of millennials who are born after 1981 to, I don't know, 1994, 1997, 1990, blah, millennials said this, The best thing that could ever happen to someone is for them to know Jesus. 94-97% of Christian millennials said that. Yeah, they're Christians. That makes sense. Here's what makes no sense. 47% agree that it is wrong to share one's personal beliefs with someone of a different faith. Let me get this straight. The best thing that could ever happen to someone would be wrong for me to talk about. Wouldn't that be weird? Like, what's the best memory of your life, sweetie? Oh, when you, like, proposed to me, but let's never talk about it ever again. We're never going to talk about it. We agree? All right, 47% of me agrees. Yeah. That's an issue here, okay? It's the information. It could be the message itself. It could also be misinformation. Check this out. I don't know if you've kept up on this research, but these three phenomena are in the neurological and the sociological and psychological literature. Number one, falsehood travels faster than truth. Number two, repetition can circumvent reason. And three, gossip seems genuine. Why are people at each other's throats? Well, number one, falsehood travels faster than truth. We read, for example, from Zhao, this is from the European Physical Journal, in 2020, he says, falsehood propagates significantly farther, faster, deeper, and broader than truth news in many categories of information. So Roosh Bazoji, he's a data scientist at MIT. He did a study of Twitter from its inception in 2006 to 2017. He studied 126 news stories, which were tweeted or retweeted 4.5 million times. Okay. He verified these stories, their truth or falsity, with, quote, six independent fact-checking organizations that exhibited 95 to 98% agreement with one another. That's peer review, right? Here's what he found. Falsehoods were 70% more likely to be retweeted than truth. Reread that last sentence and just let the chill go down your spine. 70% more likely. Even when controlling for the account age, activity level, and number of followers and followees of the original tweeter, doesn't matter. False rumors inspired replies expressing great surprise, corroborating the novelty hypothesis that when something is shocking or something is scary, it brings novelty to the brain. This creates fight or flight. This creates the dopamine release as they're looking at these news feeds over Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, whatever you think. It's the novelty hypothesis. To put it like this, here's their study. I don't know if you can read that. I blew it up. What is it that makes people more likely to spread falsity? Three emotions. Surprise, like something they've never heard of before. Disgust, or fear. And this is the culture in which we live. You know what news stories they don't spread? Those about joy and trust. That doesn't get spread. What about number two? Repetition. If you hear something enough times, it can actually circumvent your reason. This is referred to as the illusory truth effect. This was a study that was done where they had participants look at like 60 cards, like trivia cards. Well, they had three sessions and they'd have 60 cards. You know, what's your confidence in this? Scale of 1 to 7. What's your confidence in this one? Well, they did 60 cards and then waited another session, 60 cards, waited another session, 60 cards. You know what they found? In each one of the sessions, they had 20 of the cards repeated. So they saw those cards three times. The others were random. What was their confidence level in the cards that they saw first, second, and third time? It went from 4.2 confidence level to 4.7 out of 7. So just hearing something over and over and over and over, all of a sudden people start to think, I wonder if that's true. If it can be true of a trivia card, how much more when it comes to issues that are facing our culture today? Number three, gossip often seems genuine. Eric Dolan, he writes this. He says, new research in the journal Emotion suggests that people are highly influenced by gossip. I read that. I'm like, is this news? What's going on here? I finished the sentence, luckily. He says, even when the gossip is explicitly identified as untrustworthy. You can read something, it's gossip, you know it's not true, And yet, he says, people are highly influenced by it. I didn't believe it. I thought that's so crazy. So I looked up the journal article, all right, because I'm like, I don't buy this. I went and looked at the journal article. Julia Baum, she's out at the University of Humboldt in Germany. She says this, spontaneous likability, deliberate person judgments, and emotional person evaluation were strongly influenced by negative information, yet remarkably unaffected by the trustworthiness of the information. All these emotional judgments, value judgments, personal judgments, having nothing to do with the truth. Our finding, she writes, demonstrates a tendency for strong emotional evaluations and person judgments, even when they are knowingly based on unclear evidence. Guys, this is our culture where rhetoric and repetition has replaced reason, where emotion has now become the arbiter of truth. Now, you know what the good news is? Reason and truth will prevail over this, provided you think for yourself. You can't just get a feeling in your gut and all of a sudden say, well, I'm feeling it. It must make it real. Don't go right down the path of our culture, like in that mosh pit, just getting swept away by our culture. Our culture is all about this. It doesn't matter if it's true. It doesn't matter if it's real. It just matters if we can get the upper hand. Forget that. Well, finally, opposition can come from a lack of loving transformation in the Christian. Why is it that we could have people that are enemies and opponents? It's because, frankly, there's a lack of love in my own heart. Let me ask you, when you read this, what do you feel? What do you think? Paul, in the same letter, he says this in Philippians 3:18, I have told you before, and I say it again, with tears in my eyes. I'm writing this and I'm weeping that there are many out there whose conduct shows that they are really enemies of the cross. Do you see what Paul is getting at here? Paul had reached such a state in his spiritual maturity that he could say this, you know, the same people who hate God's mission are the mission. The same people that would hate Paul, the same people that have Paul in prison, these are the same people to whom the love of Christ is needed most. So, as we conclude, is taking a stand for Christ difficult? I would lie if I said it wasn't. It is. I would have to say this is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. However, is it worth it? Absolutely. I was sitting with the Lord in prayer earlier today, just sitting there and just saying, God, speak to me about this issue. Speak to me about this. And I've never heard God audibly speak, but I had that sense. If you could do this all over again, would you do it any different? And I just felt that resounding no come right out of my mouth. I wouldn't change a thing. Yeah, this is tough. But yeah, it's worth it.